I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ash Wednesday services at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome went on today without Pope John Paul II, who for the first time in his 26-year papacy did not preside over the observance. Instead, the 84-year-old pontiff has been persuaded to stay in the hospital for a few more days as he recovers from the flu. But headlines in Italian newspapers highlight a tempest in the Vatican as rumors swirl about whether the Pope should or will resign. Joining us on the line from the hospital is John Allen. He's a correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. John, first of all, how is the Pope doing?
Well, the Vatican bulletins continue to be reassuring. They tell us that the Pope is recovering, that he is spending time out of bed, that he is reading the papers and reading correspondence. He's receiving visitors, eating regularly. And it is fully expected that sometime in the next few days he's going to return to the Vatican. We expect that he will be there in time for the annual Lenten retreat, which begins Sunday evening.
So how did rumors start that he'd be resigning?
Well, I think, you know, in recent years, every time the Pope gets ill, there is speculation about resignation. In this particular case, what happened is that the Vatican's number two official, Secretary of State Cardinal Angelo Sedano, an Italian, was at a book presentation Monday evening, and afterwards he was sort of ambushed by a flock of journalists, and the resignation question was put to him. He gave a rather lengthy answer, the substance of which is that it will be up to the Pope to decide. But because he did not categorically exclude the possibility, some saw in that a kind of opening to the hypothesis of a resignation, and from there it was sort of off to the races.
Well, in fact, the Agence France-Presse is writing that there's an unholy row in the Vatican right now, a face-off between traditionalists who believe the Pope must continue to his final breath, and pragmatists who don't want to close their eyes to reality and want to start planning. Who will win out?
Well, you know, this is one of those questions that it really is entirely up to the Pope personally to decide. And John Paul has made it clear on a number of occasions, most recently Sunday, in his message in the Angelus address from the window of Gemelli Hospital, that he is determined to continue serving the Church and serving humanity as he sees it. So there is no indication that John Paul has changed his mind on the subject.
Yeah. By the way, yesterday a Church official caused a further stir by saying that the Pope can run the Church through writing or gestures if need be. Is that possible?
Yeah, canonically, there are certain kinds of decisions that only a pope can make. The appointment of a bishop, for example, the creation of a diocese, or infallible teaching on some point of faith or morals. But as long as he can indicate yes or no, he can be pope, at least in the technical legal sense.
And we should point out that while the pope is obviously physically frail, he is mentally fine, correct?
Yes. I mean, I think the truth is, like many elderly people, fatigue often makes it difficult for him to be alert for very long, and he has good days and bad days. But on the whole, his lucidity continues to be quite sharp. And in fact, he has a new book coming out that is due to be published in a matter of weeks about various forms of totalitarianism in the 20th century. So, you know, it's not the kind of thing that somebody who is out to lunch is capable of doing.
Well, still there's speculation as to who might the next Pope be. And what are some of the questions being raised?
One of the traditional places of departure, of course, for this kind of reflection is where should the next pope come from? And there is, I think, one substantial body of opinion that would say the next pope should be an Italian on the grounds that Italians kind of have an innate genetic genius for church governance. There's another body of opinion that would say it would be a forward-looking thing for the next pope to come out of the developing world, and that especially tends to come to focus on Latin America. So I think that will be one of the fault lines, whether the next pope ought to be Italian or Latin American.
And John Allen, while we have you, even though the pope isn't well, Vatican business continues. Today's Washington Post reports that the Catholic Church is revising and slightly streamlining procedures for marriage annulments. Does that mean that they'll soon be easier for Catholics to receive?
No, I think it probably in the end will mean precisely the opposite. I actually have a piece this week about some of the behind-the-scenes battles on that document. If the document is applied as it intends, it probably will result in a slight kind of tightening up on the granting of annulments, which would mean in the end fewer favorable decisions in favor of an annulment.
John Allen is Rome-based correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. John, thank you.
Pleasure, Robin.
Well, next month in Las Vegas, union leaders from around the country will meet to talk about the state of organized labor today. And the numbers don't look good. Right now, about 13% of workers in the U.S. belong to a union. But in the 50s, one-third of all workers wore the union label. So what's going on? We're going to take a few minutes to talk about unions and the American worker with David Bonnier. He served for 26 years as a Democratic congressman from Michigan. He's now chair of American Rights at Work, a labor advocacy organization. David Bonnier, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
And what's your explanation for the fallen numbers?
Well, there are various reasons for that, the loss of manufacturing, the changing economy. But I think the biggest reason for the loss in numbers from, as you pointed out, 30% down to where we are today, which is basically 13% in nationally, 8% in the private sector. The reason for this drop is I think, of a growing union-busting industry in this country. These are firms, consultant firms, law firms that have organize themselves and come in and are hired by employers if there is an organizing drive. And they use many illegal tactics. They fire workers. They provide money under the table for members who don't join unions. They have one-on-one meetings with workers, threaten them. It's very intimidating, and it's paid off for the right wing. It's part of their whole network of suppressing unions.
Well, lest this sound like the right-wing conspiracy theorists, there is actual proof of these consultants. I'm thinking of the story of Jackson Lewis, which tried for years to decertify a union in the company Enersys. That's a battery plant. Tell us about that.
Well, Enersys is a battery plant down in South Carolina, which has a very low union density. North Carolina, South Carolina, about the two lowest in the country. North Carolina only 3%, I think South Carolina maybe a little bit more. So unions aren't welcome, not part of the culture. And when workers at this battery plant decided to organize for a better life, wages, health care, benefits, all the things that we'd like to have, the company immediately hired, as 75% of all companies do, union busters or consultants to come in and beat back the drive.
This was Jackson Lewis.
This was Jackson Lewis, the biggest union busting law firm in the country out of Atlanta, Georgia. And they came in and they advised the company to fire the workers, to help decertify the union once it was there by providing money under the table to people to vote against the union and organize against it.
They paid a janitor to help run the campaign to bust the union?
They did, and he so testified. Well, the upshot of all of this is that it didn't work. They were found by the National Labor Relations Board at that time to have violated the rights of workers. So the company had to pay the workers $7.7 million in back pay for illegal firings and harassment and intimidation and other violations of the law. And then they had to pay Jackson Lewis, the company that they hired, about $2.7 million. And the upshot of all of that is that the company got mad. They got mad at the people that they hired to do their consulting work and their union busting, and they sued them. So all of what I'm telling you is now all in court record, and it's public document. And the New York Times did quite a big piece on it. What's amazing about this story is that it goes on every day in America.
Well, what do you say to critics who say that, well, actually, that's an extreme case? And in fact, the biggest problem that unions face today is that they pay people more. So, for instance, in 2003, unionized workers earned a median weekly wage of $760 compared with about $599 for non-union workers. Mm-hmm. And then because of that, companies can't afford to have as many workers. And so they fire people. And this leads to a feeling that unions drive up costs and drive out jobs.
Well, I say to that, we have 23,000 people who are fired or lose their jobs or are harassed at the workplace every year. Now, to give you some perspective on that number, back in the 1950s, when union density in the country was about 35%, 50s and the 60s, there were only a few hundred complaints against employers for that type of activity. That's increased exponentially over the last 40 years. In the 70s, it jumped up to 6,000. Today, 23,000 workers face this. Now,
you mean unionized workers face union busting.
Union busting and harassment at the workplace. And unions help an economy. Unions are a big piece of not only the economic life of a community. The unions help build middle-class America today. When I was growing up in Detroit in the 1950s, the largest company in the country was General Motors. And they had a philosophy, and it was based upon the pressure of the UAW and Henry Ford. And the philosophy was basically this, that if you work for a company, you ought to make enough to at least buy the product that they produce. So if you made enough money, you could buy an automobile. Today, the largest company in the world is Walmart, 1.4 million workers. And their philosophy is just the opposite. They pay people $9 an hour or less, and that's a spiraling down of benefits. And we built this country, we built the middle class, based upon good benefits and good wages. And I think it's a very, very dangerous precedent to move away from it. Secondly, and I'll be very brief here, is the whole question of what unionization and unions mean in terms of the right to freely associate and to our democracy. The right to associate with other like-minded people in common cause is a very cornerstone. It's the heart of our democracy. And the other freedoms are tremendously important as well. What we're doing now, the freedom of expression over this radio station, the freedom to a fair trial, the freedom of religion. But it's the freedom of association which creates the possibility for citizens to win these other freedoms. And it's being eroded in a very, very dangerous way in the United States today.
Well, in fact, you're supporting legislation called the Employee Free Choice Act. Let's explain how this works. Among other things, it would mandate that when workers choose to vote whether to unionize, they would use something called a check card or a pledge. It would be given to them by a union worker, and they'd sign it. Now, critics say that workers should vote on whether or not to unionize by using a secret ballot. In the past, unions have had much more success with this card check than with the secret ballot. So explain, what is the card check?
50% of the people at a work site decide that they want a union, they sign a card.
In front of another coworker, in front of someone who's already in the union?
It has to be legitimized in terms of somebody's signature.
Right.
And it's the way it's done in Western Europe. It's something we've done here in this country since 1935. It's been part of the Wagner Act or the National Labor Relations Act, which established the right to join unions. So it's been a part, and it's voluntary on the part of not only the worker, but what most often happens is that the employer agrees to this process as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a voluntary recognition is what it's called.
So what do you think move to secret elections is about?
Well, it's the intimidation, it's the harassment, it's the firing of workers. All of that occurs oftentimes in a ballot situation that's rigged in favor of the employers today. And that's what the Employee Free Choice Act tries to do is balance that out by, first of all, giving workers the right to a card check election. Secondly, making sure once the union is voted in that you get a decent time interval in which you get a first contract because, you know, you can vote a union in, but the employer can just stonewall and not get a contract. And that could go on for years, and it has gone on for years. And then they move to decertify the union, and the workers have nothing. And the third point is that it provides penalties, the Employee Free Choice Act, for employers who fire workers illegally. Right now, there basically is no penalty other than posting up on a bulletin board that you won't do it again.
We've been talking with former Congressman David Bonnier. He's now chair of American Rights at Work, a labor advocacy organization. Well, so much for the external factors. When we come back, how much is labor to blame for the falling union membership? Some union leaders say a lot. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about organized labor and the challenges facing unions with David Bonnier, a former congressman and now union activist. And David, we talked about union busting techniques, but how have unions been responsible for their sinking numbers?
Well, they haven't changed quickly enough. We live in a globalized world today, and we need a globalized union movement today to deal with multinational and transnational corporations, and they've been very slow. They're doing it now, but they've been very slow at moving in that direction. They also have been slow at getting at large entities, for instance, Walmart, and taking them on. And that discussion is going on, and I expect that the AFL-CIO and their affiliates and other organizations, together with people in the environment who care about land use policy, religious groups, civil liberties groups, will engage, and small business people will engage in an effort to make Walmart more accountable as the year goes on. So there are mechanisms in which the union movement has been slow, and like any other major institution, whether it's academia or the business world or Wall Street, there have been obviously some problems with wrongdoing in the labor movement. And, of course, they tend to be blown up and viewed in a negative way, and they need to be curbed, obviously, as well. But they're no more of a problem in labor institutions than they are in others in our society. That doesn't make them right. It means they got to be fought and corrected. But they tend to be exaggerated because the National Right to Work, we call it for Less Committee, is out there with a huge $15 million budget and is doing a very effective job of portraying the labor movement in a negative way. But the labor movement has done enormously positive things over the last 100 years for workers. Without the labor movement, which is one of the most important social movements in this country has ever had, they were in the forefront of the civil rights movement, the forefront of oftentimes in the women's movement and human rights movement. The labor movement was there for unemployment comp and worker comp and child restricting the hours in which children can work and the weekend, and you name the benefits that people take for granted today. It was the labor movement that was at the core and fore of that.
Well, Andy Stern, who's head of the Service Employees International Union, and we spoke of him on this program a couple weeks ago, he wouldn't argue that, but he's saying that the labor movement is failing workers today. He's one of many insurgents, if you will, who's is calling for collapsing the 60 or more current unions into 20 or so mega unions. This would mean that a lot of heads of unions would lose their jobs. He's also saying that unions should slash their dues, take the money away from the headquarters, for instance, away from training that's done at headquarters, and give it back to field organizers for recruiting to kind of restructure. That's a lot of money that would be taken away from these headquarters. Mm-hmm. So there's this sense that the new is fighting an entrenched old in the world of unions.
Well, what Andy Stern did is he opened up a discussion within the labor movement itself and the general public about the role of labor today in our society. And it's a discussion in which now many unions have joined, including the umbrella organization, the AFL-CIO, but the Teamsters, AFSCME, the CWA, the communication workers, they're all engaged in trying to figure out ways to make the labor movement more relevant today and make it work for working men and women in this country and to increase union density and to be a partner in making things work right. We know that from polling that 42 million people want to join unions today. 42 million. And there's a reason. You get better pay, you get better benefits, you get a voice at work. It's part of our democratic process. And they can't because of the things that I've mentioned earlier, the union busting and some of the other economic pieces that have changed our economic climate in this country. But people want to join unions. And how do you make them more relevant, and how do you make that happen? And Andy Stern has created a debate. And in that debate that will be played out in a discussion that the AFL-CIO and their parent organizations will have, they'll talk about Walmart, they'll talk about how to put more money into organizing, okay, which needs to be done, which is a very, I think everybody agrees with that. But, some unions will put more money in organizing, some unions haven't put more money into organizing, and it's how to get everybody organized and on board on the same page so we can make this fight for the American worker.
Yeah. Which way do you think this is going to go? I mean, if it continues at the decline that it's at, there will be no more unions.
Well, it won't continue. The pendulum will swing because the laws of economics will make it so. But it only will occur if the law allows people to exercise their rights to associate and to organize. And today it doesn't, and it needs to be changed. And if it's not changed in a fair and legitimate fashion, in a peaceful fashion, well, then what we might see, and I hope we don't see this, but we might see what we saw when during the progressive movement and during the beginning of the New Deal, and that is confrontation. And the best way to do this is to allow this basic freedom, the right to associate, to blossom, and for workers to be able to come together and organize.
Give me an example of a place where you think that unions help a business.
Well, I'll give you several examples. There's different models out there. We don't have to have the confrontational model where an employer goes out and tries to beat an organizing drive. You've got companies, for instance, like Harley-Davidson. Harley-Davidson had a great quarter last year. I mean, in terms of profits and everything, every indicator of a business success was there for them. They are one of the best employers in the country. You also have Singular, another company that does a great job. Ford Motor Company, great working relationship with its workers. Kaiser Permanente, So there are wonderful examples out there where the workers and the employers have put together a great relationship. And when you have a satisfied workforce, they're going to work harder for you. You're going to have less turnover. It's going to be better for the company and eventually for the stockholders and for the country.
That's former Democratic Congressman from Michigan, David Bonnier. He's now chair of the labor advocacy group, American Rights at Work. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, this note, Social Security isn't the only target for reform. Medicaid is as well. There's talk of making it harder for the elderly to protect their assets by transferring them to their adult children in order to be eligible for care. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Imagine waking up under a surgeon's knife in an operating room. It sounds like the stuff of horror movies, but it happens to more than 20,000 Americans a year. It's called anesthesia awareness in medical circles, and joining us to talk about it is medical columnist Judy Foreman. Judy, welcome.
Thank you.
I think this might have happened to me.
Yeah?
I was having surgery on my thumb, and I woke up and heard all these people laughing and could see the surgeon over the thumb with the knife. And I said, "What are you all laughing at?" And he said, from behind his mask, "Oh, nothing. You were telling us about the time your sister's pants fell down at the New York City Ballet. Do go on." And then the next thing I knew, I was out again. The whole story about my sister is another story, but it was terrifying. Now I was able to speak to him. Is this what you're talking about?
No, although it is a great story. If you had general anesthesia, usually they give you several different drugs. One is to block pain. One is to paralyze your muscles so that the doctors can cut through tissue better. Mm-hmm. And another is to make you unconscious and unable to remember. The fact that you could talk probably means you didn't have any of the paralytic drugs. So I would guess you were under what they call like a regional pain block, like local anesthetic, mm-hmm. plus conscious sedation, which is like heavy-duty Valium or something, mm-hmm. to make you kind of woozy and not care what's happening, but you weren't technically under general anesthesia.
Well, so what happens when a patient is under general anesthesia and experiences this anesthesia awareness? What is their experience like?
Well, it's generally horrible, and the fallout goes on for years. People get really, truly traumatized. People I talked to, the patients I talked to, had two different cases. One is a woman who was having eye surgery. And she, you know, was really grateful that her pain was going to be over. She gets the anesthesia and she heard disco music playing. And then the next thing she heard was surgeons saying, "Cut deeper, pull harder."
Oh, dear.
And she couldn't tell them. You know, she couldn't blink her eyes. She couldn't make a sound with her voice. She can't wiggle a finger or a toe. There was no way to communicate it. She wasn't feeling pain. The pain drugs were working, but the knockout drugs were not working.
Right.
And she wound up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, now, why is this becoming more of an issue now? Why are we more conscious of the fact that this is happening to people?
Well, I think more patients are coming forward with it, and possibly anesthesiologists are more willing to admit that it can happen. There was a study a year or so ago ago from Emory University that showed how often this happens, which is once or twice for every 1,000 patients who get general anesthesia. That's a lot of people. That's 20 to 40,000 a year just in this country.
And why is it happening?
Well, it's basically a mistake. They don't get you quite deep enough under anesthesia. And until recently, it's been hard to tell just how deep a patient is because there's really no way to tell whether a person's just got their eyes closed or, I mean, doctors get some clues by whether you're having tearing of the eyes or your heart rate goes up, but those aren't perfectly correlated with consciousness. So sometimes it's hard to tell when someone's out under anesthesia how deeply asleep or not they are.
Well, are there solutions for that?
There are solutions for that. There's a couple of new devices on the market called brainwave monitors that it's like a little EEG machine, like a little electroencephalograph. They put it on your forehead, a little strip of electrodes, and they can sort of gauge your level of consciousness from and give you a score from 0 to 100. And if you're starting to go up, if your number is starting to go up, that can mean that you're coming out of the anesthesia before they want you to, and then they can give you some more.
And how unpredictable is anesthesia? How you know, different is each person, and how might that lend itself to have this happening?
I think that's a really good question. There's a lot of variation among different people. And some people have to be given just light doses of anesthesia because too much would be dangerous. Like if someone has really low blood pressure to start with, if they give you too much, they could depress your blood pressure even lower. And they don't want to do that for safety reasons. So they may keep you light, which means there's a greater chance that you would wake up.
Mm. Well, getting back to the people that this happened to, you spoke to, as you said, a woman who was having her eye removed and was conscious of the entire surgery. It's horrific. And a man who remembered 40 years later that he had open heart surgery when he was 14 and was conscious during that with the hands in his chest but couldn't tell anyone about that.
That's right. I mean, it's an interesting point because some people, like the woman, know right away after surgery. They don't forget at all. They know what's happened, and their problem is getting people to believe them. This other guy that I interviewed, who's a psychologist, he repressed the whole thing. He woke up, he was 14 years old, having surgery in his heart. He felt the hands in his chest, but repressed the whole incident until like 40 years later when he had some heart arrhythmias and went to the emergency room and was getting all these heart people. They didn't open his chest, but they were sort of messing around with him. And the whole experience came flooding back. And he walked around for days and weeks feeling again the trauma of the initial thing about people with their hands in his chest and feeling numb and just absolutely terrified.
And these people have been diagnosed with real post-traumatic stress disorder. There are now lawsuits, about a dozen nationwide. So what's a patient to do? If you are going to have surgery, what should you do? What should you ask of your doctor?
Well, you can certainly ask what kind of anesthesia should you have, and if you don't need general anesthesia, don't have it. You should also ask if they have these brainwave monitoring devices, and if they do, ask if they'll use it on you, because I think it's a growing thing. There's still some reluctance on the part of anesthesiologists and some nurse anesthetists to use it until there's more data, but the data that's out there is quite good. I mean, it seems like people should be having these machines, because that can prevent, the studies have shown that can prevent a lot of episodes of waking up under anesthesia.
Judy Foreman is a syndicated medical columnist. For more on her column on anesthesia awareness, go to our website, here-now.org. And Judy, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
A Michigan company has begun testing its employees for nicotine use. The WICO company warned its workers a year ago to quit smoking or lose their jobs when random testing began last month because the company can't afford the extra cost of providing benefits to smokers. And 20 workers did quit smoking with the company's help. But Anita Eppolito says she was fired from her job as special events planner and receptionist because she refused to take the test. Well, WICO says they could not provide a response today, but we did reach Anita. She joins us on the line from Haslett, Michigan. And Anita, what was your reaction when you heard about this new policy?
I was just shocked and outraged that this could happen to me.
Are you a smoker?
That's really my business.
Oh, so you don't even want to tell if you're a smoker?
Well, I don't want to be the poster child for nicotine either here. The thing is if you choose to indulge in something such as nicotine, then you must realize that you're going to pay a high price for these items, but that's your choice.
Do you think companies should be able to dictate any kind of behavior? I mean, we are learning about companies that fired an employee for drinking after work because it was a violation of the company's no alcohol policy. That was in Indiana. A company in Alabama fired a woman who came to work with a Carrie Edwards bumper sticker. Do you think that companies should have any say?
I do. I believe if he said, the company would have said, do not smoke on my property. If it had directly affected my job performance, such as I was an athlete, you know, like if I worked for Nike or something, it just was a shocker when I found out the actual what at-will employment means. The state of New York, Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania. What happened to me can happen to absolutely every person in those states.
Anita, was it really that you felt the principle of an employee telling you you couldn't smoke at home was unfair, or was it that you just couldn't give up smoking?
Oh, my God, no, no. It was definitely the principle.
Anita Eppolito speaking to us from Hazlitt, Michigan, where she was fired from her job at the Wyco company because she refused to be tested for using a legal substance, nicotine, in the home. Anita, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. In our review of President Bush's State of the Union address, we mentioned that Bush had been booed when he talked about his plan to reform Social Security. Christian Science Monitor reporter Gail Chaddick said she didn't recall ever seeing that sort of floor demonstration during a State of the Union address. Well, Brent Esmoyle of Helena, Montana, wrote to remind us that Republicans booed President Clinton at least twice, as he entered the chamber in 1995 and then again as he spoke in 1999. In our segment on union head Andrew Stern, we referred to him and his fellow union leaders as bosses and received this email. Union bosses is characteristic of the hostility towards the labor movement. Union leaders are elected and accountable to their membership. The existence of corruption or undemocratic practices in some unions doesn't justify using the term boss. It's signed Ron Whitehorn, a proud union member in Philadelphia. Wendy Brooks of Phoenix, Arizona, wrote after our update on La Conchita, California. We'd spoken to a resident who said she wanted to move back to the seaside town despite the devastating mudslide that killed 10 of her neighbors. Well, Wendy responded, as a former La Conchita resident whose parents' house was on the verge of being destroyed in the 1995 La Conchita landslide, I find it unbelievable that residents want to continue living beneath a hill that will one day overtake the town. Old maps show that La Conchita, the little shell in Spanish, was once a fairly large hamlet in the shape of a shell, and now it is a strip of land that will one day be no more. I don't see how the local government can justify letting people remain when the result will be more death and destruction or a $100 million price tag to fix this natural landslide area. Stephen Taylor, a youth worker in New Haven, Connecticut, wrote after we visited a group of teenagers to watch Juvies, the documentary about young kids incarcerated in adult prisons. Stephen writes, "Thanks for the segment, but I was disappointed in the attitude expressed, that if you're a youth, you'd better be on your best behavior or else you might be tried as an adult. The problem is not that kids are acting up. The problem is that we choose to prosecute and incarcerate kids as if they were adults. We shouldn't be perpetuating the system by scaring kids. We should be addressing the fact that it's simply unjust and cruel to put children in prison with adults." Well, our discussion with Boston Globe music critic Richard Dyer on the famously bad singer celebrated on the CD The Muse Surmounted got a lot of response. Kim Franklin of Grants Pass, Oregon, writes, "I must say that today's story, Bad Opera, on Here and Now, was the funniest I have ever heard. I was laughing so hard I had to turn down the radio for fear of interrupting my coworkers. Thank you for showing a balance between professionalism and pure fun." Well, another listener felt it was in poor taste to showcase singers like Florence Foster Jenkins, but many of you wrote to point out that Jenkins was recently the subject of an off-Broadway play and once had a sold-out concert at Carnegie Hall. And Michael Ellis of Springfield, Pennsylvania added, "In Britain, the BBC had a regular program of listener requests, and Florence Foster Jenkins was played regularly. Eccentrics are highly valued in Britain, so that may explain their interest in her." You also asked Richard Dyer, "How hard is it to sing badly if you're properly trained?" Well, let me introduce you to Jonathan and Darlene Edwards, a fictional couple created by acclaimed jazz singer Joe Stafford and her husband.
With someone sharing a delightful chat of this and that and cocktails for two as we enjoy...
Not Not only does she intentionally sing wonderfully badly as Darlene Edwards, he plays the piano equally badly. They even won a Grammy one year. Well, we'll leave you on another musical note. For those of you who asked about the music that ended our tour of architect Philip Johnson's first glass house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it was New York Counterpoint by Steve Reich. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In competitive fencing, some things are understood. The blade is not sharpened, and in any event, you'd never purposefully scar your opponent's face. Well, those rules are turned upside down in modern-day secret dueling societies in Germany. Fraternal organizations that draw on ancient rituals and draw blood as a sign of honor. Members in these German clubs are brothers in the business and political corridors of Germany. Jonathan Green, a reporter and fencer from England, gained access to these secret societies and wrote about it for the Financial Times. He spoke with us at the time and described what these fencers do and wear.
Well, they wear chain mail. There's protection around the neck to protect the carotid artery. They also wear steel sort of goggles on their sort of faces so that the nose and the eyes can't be scarred. But anything above the neckline is a target. And they also wear chain mail sort of shirts to protect their sort of upper arms and torsos as well.
There's drinking involved. There are doctors standing by to sew up the wounds, and they are required to be absolutely impassive.
Yeah. I mean, the big sort of thing with this is that it's a test of manhood. So to flinch in any way or to shirk means that you're instantly disqualified and you've got to do the whole thing all over again.
Who joins these groups?
I think it's people from well-bred families. It's normally they have an introduction from their fathers or their grandfathers who were old boys of the cause, known as Alteherren. And that's normally how they join. But I think in the past sort of 10, 20 years, they're starting to have new sort of like recruits from people who are just sort of fascinated with it and want to join.
Well, we read in your article there are 200 of these student corps in Germany, and many Germans just hate them.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they sort of accuse them of being sort of Nazis. And I think that, you know, because any secret society tends to draw criticism from people who don't know what it's about, and I think that that's why they sort of let me into their world to, you know, to sort of show me and to say, hey, look, you know, that's about the furthest thing away that we are. Like, we're not sort of Nazis at all. We just hark back to the German traditions, which go back five centuries or so.
Mm. And in fact, you know, obviously they preceded the Nazis by hundreds of years and were banned in some cases by Nazis for defending their Jewish members for not kowtowing to Hitler.
Yes, that's totally right. I mean, the corps sort of have such a strict code of honor that once you join and you show that you're part of the fraternity, then they'll do, you know, then they will take care of you. And that goes beyond any class, race, because religious thing, it cuts across everything.
Well, cuts.
Excuse me, yes.
Excuse
the pun, yeah.
Because they do cut each other. I mean, and then what? They belong to this organization and sometimes live in these beautiful old homes that house these organizations for hundreds of years. But then does it really help them down the road?
I don't know. I mean, some people say it does and other people say it doesn't. I mean, I don't think, you know, that it's such a sinister organization that they're sort of guaranteed a job and this, that and the other. But I do think it's probably a bit like being in the military, sort of being in the Marine Corps, I mean, at the end of that, I mean, you have a tight bond still with the people that you've seen service with.
What was it like for you to stand there and watch this duel? I mean, there's super sharp blades, which just even reading about it made my heart jump. What was your reaction?
There's times when you really don't want to look at it. You just want to turn away. I mean, you're waiting on that cut, and they go sort of back and forth and back and forth, and every sort of four swipes they clean the blade, and then they do another four. And then sort of to when it happens, it's so fast. I mean, I remember this guy's arm sort of coming up, and it was like a sapling branch swinging back and round. And it sort of split open like big as this other guy's forehead, with just this barely discernible needle thin line, this red line, and then all of a sudden the blood started to gush and went down over his goggles and the chain mail. And I think even up to that point he didn't even realise that he had been cut, you know. I think that the sort of adrenaline was coursing that sort of strongly. But there was also a tremendous amount of fear in the room. I mean, one of the fencers, they have to sort of hold their swords aloft sort of before they start. And I literally saw this guy's hand sort of shaking like an antenna on a car. I mean, it was absolutely terrified.
I can almost hear it, you know.
Well, there is actually that sort of snick in the air, which is, you know, which is a strong memory I have of it. It's just sort of rhythmic snicking noise of the blades going through the air, and because there's no other sort of sound at all, actually. But I think, yeah, I mean, some people just can't go through with it and sort of back out, and then, of course, they can't sort of be in the Corps, you know.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Jonathan Green's story about the secret German fencing society appeared in the Financial Times Weekend magazine. Minnie Mae Murray died yesterday at the age of 85. We didn't know her, but felt we did. Her husband, Boston Globe columnist Donald Murray, wrote how she would turn up the volume on the TV to let him know that the air conditioning was too cold, how they fought for the covers in bed, or she jealously guarded her territory in the kitchen. They bickered. They were in love for 54 years. Donald Murray's column was called Now and Then. Recently, we also learned how Minnie Mae coped with Parkinson's disease, dementia, and eventually a move into an assisted living center. Don's colleague, Tom Long, wrote Minnie Mae's obituary in today's Boston Globe. Tom, what else did Don tell us about Minnie Mae in the last columns?
The loss of memory. As she got ill and slipped in and out of reality, he lived their life through memories. And how sometimes it wasn't important to talk, it was more important to touch than to say anything.
Tom, what do you think it is about Minnie Mae that resonated with so many people? Your colleague Eileen McNamara wrote today that she knew more about Minnie Mae's daily habits than she did about her own mother. What was it about Minnie Mae that resonated?
She represents an archetype of people that don't get written about all that often. The mothers of the 1950s that stayed home and kept the home fires burning while their husband went out and grabbed the glory. He had a wonderful way of bringing her in and making it clear that she was as responsible for his successes as he was.
Tom Long of the Boston Globe. Here is a passage from Don Murray's column yesterday, letting readers know his wife of 54 years, Minnie Mae Murray, was gone.
My wife, Minnie Mae, always wanted to be in charge. I met her the day before Valentine's Day in 1951, such a short time ago. She talked cooking, so I brought her a spice rack the next evening. She shut the apartment door behind her and glared at me, said I was presumptuous. She opened her apartment door to escape the unexpected suitor, but before the door was shut, I had invited Minnie Mae out to dinner. She stopped, thought, and issued a command. I'll cook dinner. The door opened and has never been closed. 54 years later, our daughters sit beside me as we watch Minnie Mae sleep with a sweet content. She feels no pain, suffers no lack of dignity. It is as she had wanted.
Minnie Mae Murray, wife of Boston Globe columnist Donald Murray, died yesterday at the age of 85. is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.